Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. Sally Rush Wagoner grew up in Aberdeen, South Dakota. She went on to be awarded one of the first doctorates in the country for work in women's studies. She's the founder of one of the first college-level women's studies programs in the United States. She's taught women's studies courses for 50 years, and she has a new book called The Women's Suffrage Movement. It's an anthology. Women's suffrage is a story that's been told in the same rather white fashion for over a century, and this book gives voice to those women left out of the other history books. Sally Rush Wagoner is with us on the phone now. Welcome. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Oh, thank you, Lori. It's a delight. I feel like I'm back in home in South Dakota. I feel like I'm back home.
Welcome home.
And thank you. Unlike
you, when I read this book, so much of it is new for me, which is a little frustrating. I found myself at several points, stomping my feet and saying, why have I not ever heard this before? Tell us about, let's start here with the importance of beginning the story in the right place and going back 1,000 years before what we genuinely recognize as the beginning of the American women's suffrage movement.
Yeah, I think we're beginning to let go of a little bit of that white arrogance that says that the history of this land begins when white people got here. The reality is that Haudenosaunee women, Native women, had political voice on this land 1,000 years ago, and they continue to have that political voice today. At least 1,000 years. And the reason I focus on the Haudenosaunee, the Iroquois Confederacy of Six Nations, is because they influenced and inspired the suffragists that began the women's rights movement in upstate New York. They were their neighbors. They knew the Haudenosaunee women. And they saw the reality of women's rights when they were told it was not possible. I mean, these were women who had no right to their body. They had no right to their children. Husbands could will away an unborn child. And they had no right to property. They, once married, were dead in the law. Anything they earned, wages from their work, went to their husbands. Husbands could rape wives. They could beat wives. These were women who had legal and social and religious invisibility. They saw empowered Native women, and that changed the trajectory of our history.
Does one exist without the other? I mean, how different would it be? Because it occurs to me that if they had had no one to look to as a model of anything else, mm-hmm. certainly it would have taken a lot more time if it would have happened at all.
And I think, you know, when you live in a world in which this is the only thing you see and this is the only thing that you're told is possible, mm-hmm. you have to see something in order to know. I think you're absolutely right. And here are these clan mothers. They continue to inspire me today. You know, they choose the chiefs. They nominate them. They hold them in position. It's the balance of responsibilities. They remove them if the men do not behave appropriately and work for the seventh generation. One of the qualifications, one of the absolute things that a man cannot have done to be a chief, he cannot have abused a woman. That inspires me, I have to say. That's a civilized world.
Tell me about some of those relationships and the interactions between some of the people that we have read about in women's history. What were their relationships with indigenous women and that political voice like?
Well, let me just give you a couple examples. Lucretia Mott, before she comes to Waterloo and they plan the Seneca Falls Convention in 1848, she spent a month with women, Seneca women, at Cattaraugus, which is one of the Seneca communities. She writes in the only account of her summer that I found is in the anti-slavery paper, The Liberator. And in it, she spends about 4 paragraphs talking about the women at Cattaraugus and what's going on there. And then there's about a paragraph about Seneca Falls and the convention. Matilda Jocelyn Gage is adopted honorarily into the Wolf Clan of the Mohawk Nation. supports treaty rights, supports sovereignty. She's one of the three major leaders of the National Woman Suffrage Association, along with Susan B. Anthony and Elizabeth Cady Stanton. One more example, the International Council of Women in 1888, Alice Fletcher, who's an ethnographer, talks about being with Omaha Nation women, and one of the women gives away a horse. And Alice Fletcher says, oh, hadn't you better check with your husband? And the women, these Native women, are just laughing their heads off at her, like, what the heck is this about? You know, they have no idea why you would even ask your husband. It's your property. She said, just for a minute, I forgot that I was not with white women who had no right to their property. Mm-hmm. She then goes on to say that she has been told by Native women that they are really concerned about what's going to happen to their rights when they come under United States law. And she talks about talking to a chief, and I've been able to track down it was Sitting Bull that she was talking to. And Sitting Bull said, I am really fearful of what will happen to our people when we come under United States law. For the men, it will be hard, but I am especially concerned about the women because they will lose their rights as Indians and they'll lose their position as women. He said, what do these white men care for women anyway? They prove it. All they care about the women is a chance to get another 160 acres of land, you know, under the Homestead Act. So they were well aware of what was going on. Native people were aware of what was happening to them, and the white women were well aware of the superior position to their own that Native women held.
When you look at that difference, it's hard to imagine a greater difference in history between the political standing and the voice and the leadership that a group of people had to what they then was forced upon them. With violence and deception than Indigenous women.
Yeah. And the number of disappeared women today, the Native women that, you know, they have disappeared. What's happened to them? And the absence of law enforcement to track that down and to stop that. And we know that the violence to them is done primarily by white men.
I was talking to somebody just the other day, this week, in fact, about missing and murdered Indigenous women, and she was talking about the invisibility and the lack of justice. I want to get at the messages from this book and from the research that you've done for women today, Native American women working with women of, white women, African American women. Let's talk about the messages for activists and leaders today that come from your research? That's a big question, so help me narrow it down to something specific that you can speak to.
Well, one of the things that was the painful part of writing this book was looking at the racism of the movement, which becomes institutionalized by 1890. And the National American Woman Suffrage Association begins to make the argument, give women the right to vote because it will be a way to maintain white native-born supremacy, because white women outnumber Negroes and immigrants and will keep white supremacy going. And they allow the states, they practice states' rights, and they allow the states to do basically whatever they want. And some of the southern states segregate. They choose to segregate. They work just for the vote for white women, and they work for voter suppression. Voter suppression is still an issue today with people of color. Obviously, in South Dakota, it's an issue. It's an issue in the South as well. I'll tell you the takeaway that I take is that we need to, before we can celebrate 2020, as the centennial of woman suffrage, we need to acknowledge that it was not an endpoint, that partly because of the racism, women in the South, African American women, did not really have the vote, neither did African American men, until the 1960s and the voter laws that overturned the Jim Crow laws. For me today, the message is leadership comes from women of color. If we look at, you know, the pipeline, where did that leadership come from? It came from women. We look at the vote in 2018, and how did that vote go? Well, if we look at the difference between African American women and white women's voting records, I would say leadership comes from women of color, and those are the ones who I see leading us forward to freedom today.
The book is called The Women's Suffrage Movement. It's a new Penguin classic, so you can get it in paperback. It's so well done. So much in here, Sally, that I really hope sincerely this is the beginning of more conversations that we can have with you here in South Dakota. But we really appreciate this book, and we really appreciate your time today.
Oh, my pleasure, and I'd love to visit with you more.